My name's Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. Member of the Miami Men's Group in Miami, Florida. Bunch of misogynists that come around twice a week. Curse and spit a lot. They asked me to come here because I've been in AA a long time. You can tell by looking at me, I've been somewhere for a long time. And I'm delighted to be here. You want me to read this? I guess this is from the hotel.
Okay.
It says, just sit there, will you please? It says here, in case of fire, would all the non-alcoholics remain seated until the alcoholics are well clear of the building? The book, Alcoholics Anonymous, which you see, it's the blue one, this one, you see before me, instructs us that we are to speak in a general way about what we were like and what happened and what we are like now. A lot of people sometimes get that wrong. They think it says, tell us what it was like. You sure don't want me to tell you that, do you? You know what it was like. And I'd much rather talk about what I am like. I may not be much, but I'm all I think about. I'm 100% self-absorbed. And so anyhow, usually the way that's done is we make reference to our backgrounds and so forth and so on. So I will proceed that way. I grew up, or at least I got a little taller, in one of the neighborhoods in New York City, the South Bronx to be exact. And my neighborhood was rough and it was tough, and it was Irish. Now I don't know, you know, what happens here in this part of California, whether you understand these things or not, but you would actually see people on the street under the influence of alcohol. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And if you look where I was living, you'd see a little drinking. My mother, the widow O'Keefe, was known to take drinks from time to time. When the pressure got on, Kitty would go for the light wines and the spirits, and something would fly, usually one of his children. I just found out about 4 or 5 years ago, I found out I'm from a dysfunctional family. Well, it's all right. I got a therapist, and we got in touch with my inner child. Who was 70 years of age. And that put me in touch with my emotions and enabled me to resolve all the issues. So now that we have that horse shit out of the way, I'll get on with the AA part of the meeting. So I was trying to grow up as best I could, and I was, of course, going to the parochial school system, in a manner of speaking. I held a neighborhood record for being thrown out of high school, a record previously established by my brother Billy. They kept throwing me out. I don't know what was the matter. And I don't know how this happened. To this minute, I don't know how it happened, but I ended up going to college. And not only did I go to college, I went to college in the state of Vermont, which in drinking terms is a third world country. And my time there, there was no bars. There was just restaurants. And these people sat around and they drank beer out of bottles and they sang college songs. They wore white shoes in the wintertime. And acted very collegiate. And I was trying to fit in. I got a pair of shoes. And I learned the words to some of those dopey songs they sing in college, and I did get sort of collegiate. World War II was ending. We were winning. So I had one of those, everything was going great. I had one of those ideas that come, you know. So I got a haircut and joined the Navy. And ended up in San Francisco in a minesweeper, on a minesweeper. I hate to be indelicate in front of such a nice group of people. But I better tell you, I had a lot of trouble with my kidneys when I drank. And in the Navy, we slept three to a tier. Don't get ahead of me, ladies. This is not easy here, what I'm doing. A little cooperation, please. So the new guy slept on top, and I came back from my first liberty with all the beer in me I could handle. And I went to sleep, and I had one of these attacks. And I suppose the fellow that slept below me thought he'd be wet sometime in his naval career. But it hadn't occurred to him it would happen while he was asleep. I got to meet him. I hadn't met him before. And I was immediately transferred to a lower bunk. The rest of my naval career was just as distinguished. And a few years later, I was back in the neighborhood, undecorated, unhonored, unloved. And I was trying to find my mother. She was out in the weeds somewhere. And my brother Billy was absent without leave from the New York City Police Department. Billy had had an argument with a man who fell off a roof. And the son of a bitch lived. Identified the Irish cop, so Billy went west and went into a more peaceful line of work. He went back to the Marine Corps. And the government was giving veterans $20 a week for 52 weeks. We called it the 52-20 Club. And I was a charter member. I showed up for my checks. I gravitated to the local bar. I was with some of the men I had gone to grammar school, high school with. We were planning a life of petty crime. There was something about a stolen car ring in which I would be some type of an executive. And I had one of these clear thoughts that penetrate every half century. I recalled that I had been in college. So I got on a bus and went up there, and I arrived in a blizzard, and I walked in this place, and there they were. They were still sitting around the tables. They were drinking beer out of bottles. They were singing those songs. They were wearing the shoes. So I got another pair of shoes. Now a grateful government was sending me a sum of money monthly, which meant I could drink, which I did. And one time I was staggering around the campus in my usual condition, beautiful place, and there was a list of names on the bulletin board of people qualified to graduate, and my name was on the list. And that was excellent news. I thought I had another year to go. And, well, you can't keep track of everything, you know. And, so I notified the widow to come attend this great event, and that was a very, very tender occasion. The widow and her youngest child staggering around under the elms. Bring tears to a stone, I'll tell you. Some years later, after I became rich, I was a trustee of that college, and I go to meetings, and they still talk about my mother. It's just not so often in the state of Vermont that they see a little old lady get off a train drunk at 9 o'clock in the morning and start a fist fight with the guy with the luggage. You know? Great lady she was. So I came back from college, and my family is quite Irish, and it was run by my uncles. I didn't have a father. I had uncles. And they voted unanimously that I become a New York City policeman. He goes, that's what my father had been, that's what my brother had been, and that's what all my uncles and cousins were doing, except for the two morons that worked for the phone company. Well, I told him I'd received a scholarship to law school and I'd be unemployed for several years. That was received with mixed emotions. Well, that's what happened. I went off to law school. I didn't know the first thing about law or lawyers. We didn't have any lawyers in my neighborhood. We had cops and we had priests. We didn't need any lawyers. I hate to be disloyal to the profession that's done so well for me and for mine, but I have to tell you that when I arrived at law school, I found I was in the company of the greatest collection of stiffs that had ever assembled under one roof. God, they were deadly. They all had on a blue suit and a pair of eyeglasses. So I got a pair of glasses. I didn't need glasses, but I got into uniform and I played the game. And I went on a wagon because law school scared me. And I didn't drink. And as a result of that, I did well. And as a result of that, I was taken into a Wall Street law firm. And they hired me as sort of the resident immigrant. It was not a total loss, however. I did learn to say, oh, really, instead of no shit. Oh, really? Oh, really? comes easily to the tongue, does it not? Oh, really? My superiors there determined that I should be trained as a trial lawyer, so I was sent up to the courthouse in New York City to learn my trade, and I was only there momentarily, really, and I found out all the really bright people were across the street in a saloon. So I moved my office into the saloon, and I started to drink again, and this time, of course, I drank with a great difference. I was an attorney, and I was not to be caught drinking shots and beers. I like to drink scotch in a tall glass and ice. You sip on that. It's very genteel, and it takes a little while, but it gets the job done. I was introduced to all of the rituals and all of the ceremonies that surround the very, very dry martini. And to this evening and to this moment, my love, my admiration, and my affection for the very, very dry martini is surely the greatest case of unrequited love the world has ever seen. I was so loyal to these things and they almost killed me. It was necessary in my natural development that I be married. Things were going so good, I figured, let's see what I can do to screw this up. And I had located a lady, or she had located me. Who knows how these things happen? I was a bellhop in a hotel, and she was a guest. And that pretty well characterizes the relationship right now. Ms. O'Keefe, my wife, I usually call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. She's been current for 43 years. So I think she's got a shot at a permanent position. She keeps up the good work. And a lovely woman, and she's known to some of the people here. From a totally different background than my own, she was raised in a lovely home with devoted parents and a fence and a dog and all that stuff. And I will not burden you with the details of my wedding day, but I assure you that when the O'Keefes from the South Bronx hit the Westchester Country Club, they set a few records. We settled down and set up housekeeping. Ms. O'Keefe began to produce children with the frequency and the regularity That is known only to the Roman Catholic. Oh, brother. And we count everything by the children. After the second one, I think it was the second one, it might have been the third one, somewhere along the line there, I got a phone call from the law school I had attended, the Fordham University School of Law. It's a large Jesuit institution, and it's been there a long time. And they appointed me to the faculty, and I became Professor O'Keefe, and oh, brother, there I was, the boy professor, and I was scared to death. So I decided I would drink less, because I knew I drank more than I should. And so I decided to drink less, and when I was drinking less, because when you drink less, you're so goddamn nervous, you better drink more, or you'll kill yourself with just drinking less stuff, you know? It's the only room in America where I could say that, and everybody said, that's right, you should. So there I was, and I drank, I knew I drank like a pig. I was 27 years old, maybe 28, I forget. So after I tried drinking less for a number of years, it worked out that I was a good teacher. I was a competent teacher. Once I found that out, there was no need to go through this nonsense of drinking less anymore. I only knew one way how to drink. My father died when I was 2. I had my brother Billy. He was 4 years older, and he would not take us to be brothers. He was about 6'3", he was sort of a poster Marine. You know, he looked like one. He acted like one. And he was my father and my big brother and my hero all in one. And I tried to do everything just like Billy. And I drank like Billy. I drank till I fell down, or the place went on fire. Well, maybe the cops showed up, something like that, would interfere. I never knew that he was supposed to stop. He never stopped. And I'd see people leaving. I'd wonder, where the hell are they going? You know, they know something I don't know. That would make me nervous. And so I'd drink more. I wonder about them. And around this time, Mrs. O'Keefe began to go a little mental. I'm sorry to tell you that, but actually her mother was never right. I mean, she didn't have to be put anywhere, anyway. She was just not right. And I don't like to bring up family matters like this, but it explains a lot. And Ms. O'Keefe began to talk ugly. You know, you won't believe it. You know what she said to me? You won't believe this. It was a married woman talking like that. She said there was something radically wrong with the way I drank. Well, that's gross disloyalty. And I had to explain things to her. She is not an attorney. Not. She doesn't have the benefit of a legal education. So obviously I would have to explain things to her. And so I did. I explained to her the relativity of drinking. Now stay with me for a moment on this one. Some people drink more than other people. All right? Yes. And I say on a relative scale, I am not such a big drinker. As a matter of fact, I would say, I don't drink as much as my mother. And she would say, nobody drinks. And then what am I to do? I went over and saw Mom. Well, this drove her mental. So she betook herself to her physician, who, as you might imagine, is an obstetrician. And he could find nothing the matter with her until she, very disloyally, told him about me. And I'm one of the few alcoholic men who come to Alcoholics Anonymous upon the advice of a gynecologist. She came home and she brought me a message. Here's the message. She said her doctor, the obstetrician, had diagnosed me as an alcoholic. Oh, I was outraged. And I rose to the occasion, as is my custom. and I took a very, very dim view of a physician who would diagnose a patient without ever having seen the patient. I was against that shabby type of medical practice, all too common in our country today. Then I went into high gear and I asked Mrs. O'Keefe a question to which she has not yet discovered the answer. I asked her what kind of a man became an obstetrician in the first place. You got it. And this conversation was coming downhill at a terrible rate, and then it happened. I don't know how this happened. It happened. I cannot explain to you how this happened. I can explain many, many other things to you, and I probably will in the second or third hour of this terrific talk. But in the middle of all of my yelling and posturing, I stopped. It's very painful to remember. And I admitted to Mrs. O'Keefe, for the first time I had ever admitted to anyone, that there was at least the possibility that on some occasions, more than a several, I had allowed myself to be overserved. And that was as far as I care to go. Mrs. O'Keefe is a woman of great resources. She went into action, and 3 days later, I was a prisoner in a mental institution in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was only there a matter of seconds when I discovered a very serious architectural deficiency in that building. There was no doorknob on my side of the door. And in addition to everything else horrible that was going on that day, it happened to be the occasion of my 35th birthday. And I mentioned this to a man in a white coat who happened to be around. And I very carefully explained to that cretin that on that very day, I had attained age 35. And therefore, under the Constitution of the United States of America, I was eligible for the office of president. He urged me not to plan any campaigns. He said there were two other presidents in residence. And he administered to me some vile narcotic and immediately went out of my life. I never saw him again. I came up for air about a week later, and of course I demanded to see the head of the hospital. Of course, who else would I speak to? And this poor man came to see me in that smarmy medical voice they have, and he said, "Tell me, Professor, why is it you drink so much?" So I told him of my wealthy parents. I told him how they used to travel a great deal, and I had been left in the hands of servants who were very cruel. And I had turned to alcohol because I was insecure. And he said he had seen that before. I said, "Well, you're seeing it again." He said, "Yes, I recognize it." And he went away. And a few minutes later, one of his colleagues came in, and he asked me the same question. Well, one doesn't lie to a physician. So I told him of my impoverished youth in the Bronx. I told him about how I used to get beat up by my drunken mother. I even talk about the time my sister Marie took one of my toys and I chased her with a knife for a couple of days. He said I'd come to the right place. He said help was at hand and medical science would help me. And maybe I could drink again safely. And I said, you could be my doctor. And I was living there, and there was no way out. And I was playing Monopoly with some people who were there, the three of them. And they weren't alcoholics. They were just there. And we had a Monopoly marathon going. And one of them was under the impression that I was his real estate broker. Now, if you know anything of the game of Monopoly, and some nut thinks you're his real estate broker, you do fairly well. And I had the boardwalk, I had a number of hotels, and I was not drinking. And I wasn't thinking of drinking, I was thinking about playing Monopoly all day long. And this was the so-called Monopoly theory and therapy for alcoholism, which works just as well as the rest of the crap they hand out from various places I've heard about. And I was into about a week of the Monopoly Marathon, and they said I had a visitor. Well, who the hell? Nobody was visiting me. And so I went to wait for the visitor. And through the door of that room came this very imposing-looking man with a suit, tie and all, and said he was from the Darien, Connecticut group of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the hospital had given up on me, and they thought he might bring me this program that he had, and I immediately reverted to my origins in the Bronx, and I called them some bad names, and I almost had him by the throat. You know what he said to me? Listen to this. You know what he said to me? You probably won't even believe this. You know what he said? Shut up. Just like that, shut up. I intuitively knew that they had neglected to tell him who I was. So I thought it would be important for him to know that. And so I began to tell him who I was. You know, and he said, sit down and shut up. Well, he was a very imposing man. I was not well. So for the first time in 35 years, and he began to explain to me, as I've been trying to indicate to you, what he was like, what happened to him, and what was going on in his life then. It was a fascinating story. And he said, would you like to go to meetings? 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 What type of meetings? He said, meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Oh, no. Meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those kind of meetings. He said, yes, Alcoholics Anonymous. Where are those meetings, sir? He said, they're outside. I said, I'm going with you. And I was not the best of motives. And he also gave me matches. Nobody else had allowed me to have matches. And that bespoke a certain confidence, I thought. And so he took me around, and I made arrangements for me to go. And I came back home. I lived in a village in New York called Lachmann, very nice place, and I lived with some very nice people, Miss O'Keefe, and a whole bunch of children. God, there's an awful lot of children. And I think most of them are mine, too. And I don't remember all so much of that. That was a difficult time, and I don't remember much of it. In those days, this is in the 60s, the medical community was of an opinion that the disease of alcoholism was caused by some type of a Valium deficiency. And so when you exited one of these places, they gave you a big jar of Valium so you could keep your level up and not become deficient. So I used to just carry them in my pocket with the change, and the instructions were, if you felt like a drink, have one of these. And I felt like a drink all the time, you know. So I'm walking around, my head buzzes a lot, and I'd fall asleep at dinner, things like that. So I know myself fairly well. I guess I thought I'd come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You would recognize me as a superior person. You would elect me your president. I was always president if I joined something. And at the end of my term as president, we'd have another dinner, and I'd get another award, and onward and upward, another chapter written in an already fascinating life. So it should come as no surprise to you when I tell you I was drunk 10 months later. I lasted 10 months, and then I was drunk, and nothing happened. I didn't relapse. I got drunk. And I'm not going to take you through it all. It takes too long, and I still get the willies just thinking about it. The hair on my neck starts to go up. But let me just indicate to you, it was, without question, it was the worst period of my life. It was murder. It was pure and simple murder. I would drink a week, and I wouldn't drink a month. I'd drink a month, I wouldn't drink a week. I would drink and come to these meetings. I would drink, I would come to the meetings, and then I would drink. I never knew when it would start, and I sure never knew where I'd be when it was all over. And it wasn't as though I didn't know about alcoholism. I knew about alcoholism. I had a memory. I remembered the neighborhood. I'd seen it a million times. I knew about my family. I'd been to the funerals. I knew why they died. Everybody knew why. It was sort of a joke, you know. Say, doesn't he look good now? He stopped drinking. Yeah. And I don't know what I thought. I suppose I thought, now it's my turn. Now it's my turn. I guess I thought. I don't know what I thought. But I knew about drinking. And I tell you this. As I stand here before you, I did not think it was possible for me to stop drinking. I didn't think so. And then, one day, my time came. My time came one day. Now, I don't know any more about this than you do. But it seems to me that there is a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And I say to you, there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. I don't know where this line is for you. How would I know? I only know what happened to me. And I think it is a personal and an individual thing. And I think it's different in each case. And for some, it may be death. And that's how it was for my brother Billy. They called one night from the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, and he had collapsed on the street, and they brought him to the vets, and he died of alcoholism. And he died as alcoholics oftentimes do. He was 48 years old. He had no friends, he had no family. And he was a long, long way from our neighborhood in the Bronx. But I'll tell you this. My brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. He stopped. And for other people, it can be something trivial. But that line is there, somewhere. And we all come to it in our own way. and I think in God's time. And I showed up on a day that wasn't really much different from many other days. I was 3 or 4 days away from a drink. I was nervous. I was thirsty. I had money. Dangerous thing. For an alcoholic. And I had a decision to make. There was a bar in the lobby of the building, and I had gotten a job. So I called a longtime friend of mine, a longtime member of this program. His name is John. He's my sponsor. And I told him what was going on with me. And he came over. And boy, he looked good. And I felt so bad. And so I asked him what I could do to be as successful as he was. And, you know, he gave me that look. You know the look they give you, those sponsors? And he said, don't drink, and you go to the meetings, you'll be fine. You see, he didn't really appreciate the problem. And I told him, that. I said, John, you know, you don't really know things. It isn't drinking. My problem is not, it never was. It's where I work here. This is not the place for me. Well, he said, if you don't drink and you go to the meetings, you could get a better job. I said, yeah, but at home it's worse. You know, I'm not even allowed to go up there anymore. She got a court order. He said, yeah, well, you know, if you don't drink and you go to her meetings, she might take you back. I said, well, you know, I'm being sued by a bank. He said, I read about it in the paper. Oh, good. He said, if you don't drink and you go to her meetings, you could settle a case like that. I sensed there was no dialogue there. He really wasn't dealing with my emotional sobriety. And I guess he sensed that too. He said, you're not doing anything. Come on. And he made a couple of phone calls, and he took me over to Grand Central, and he put me on a train up to where I later lost my mind. It was about a 40-minute ride. About halfway up, I reconsidered. You understand? You know, what the hell did I must have panicked. Call this moron. Don't drink. Yeah, sure. My ass don't drink. Wait till this train stops. That was my attitude. I got off the train in Lashman. Standing on the platform was the guy who delivered the mail to the house. His name was Al. He was chairman of the local AA group. And I didn't know that. And Al said, get in the car. I said, Al, please. No offense. I don't hang out with mailmen. All right? He said, somebody called me about you from New York. Would you please shut up and get in the car? Boy. So I got Al's car. I said, Al, I seem to be in some difficulties. He said, well, if you don't drink, you got me. So here I am, 3,000 miles from home. And you want some advice? I'm from out of town, after all. You want some advice about all of this? You ready for it? Here you go. Don't drink. You go to our meetings. Everything's going to be all right. Lighten up. And then he took me that night. It was November 24th, 1965. And he took me up to the meeting. And I haven't had a drink since. At first I had a day. I had a day because Al and John gave me a day. They made me a gift, a present for the day. And that's what they do for new people. We give them a gift of a day or two. And then God gives them the rest. And I wish you had known my sponsor. He's a great guy. He is a great guy. In fact, I'll be with him in October. And he was something. Well, he really was. I would say to him, I don't feel well. He'd say, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. I said, well, you know how new people are. I was no different. I'd say, when am I going to get a good job? He said, when you're ready. I said, well, how do I know I'm ready? He said, you'll have a good job. So I thought I told you that. Oh. I said, well, you know, I'm very, very nervous. What do you think I should do? He said, hold on. How should I hold on? He said, let go. It was like dealing with a Zen master. It was all very ephemeral there. And we had a guy in the group who was very smart. I forget his name, Charlie or something. He was a very smart guy. And he had about 3 months, you know. My sponsor had about 10 years. So if I wanted to talk to somebody, I talked to Charlie, because he had 3 months. And you could talk to a guy that had 3 months. 10 years, you begin to glaze over. Jesus Christ. So what is he trying to prove? And Charlie said to me one night, I got it. I said, you got what? He said, I got the whole thing. He said, it's capillaries. I said, I did it in the laboratory. He said, it's capillaries. The alcoholic has malfunctioning capillaries. And we get that straightened out, and we'll all be fine. Charlie, you are a wonder. I'm in awe. I stand in awe of you. Then John showed up. I said, John. He said, get the book. This book here, the blue one. He said, find the part about the capillary. I said, I don't think so. I read it, you know, doesn't seem to. He said, listen to me, Professor. When he was annoyed with me, he called me Professor. When he liked me, he called me Sailor or something. Say, listen to me, Professor. He said, if it's not in there, you don't have to know about it. If it was necessary for your sobriety that you know about it, it will be in there. I say, yeah, but I think. He said, no, no. No, don't do that. You're only going to hurt yourself. There's no chapter in there called Into Thinking. Don't bother with that. He said, now read this. You know what he told me? He was so helpful. He said, read the black part here. Don't read that other part. He said, just the black stuff. Don't read this white part, he said. He said, if you read that white part, he said, you'll go blind. I was already going blind from the other thing, so I didn't want to go blind twice, you know. And, you know, I found out now over the years is that what he said was true. What he said was true, but it's pretty much all in there. And, you know, it's not a difficult thing we do here. Huh? I don't find it difficult. There are no mountains to climb. There's simply a path that we follow. And what is a path other than a way made clear by the steps of those who have gone before us? And if you are walking along this beautiful countryside here and you see a path, you know immediately that other people have gone that way and left the path by their steps. And you know that it must go somewhere or there wouldn't be so many taking a path of it. And what's better if you're traveling a path that you don't know very much about? Then you have someone with you to guide you along the path. Someone who knows where that path comes out in our context of sponsor. So I had that. I had a home group. I had a sponsor. And I learned pretty much. I listened tonight and in that portion of the fifth chapter, which is sometimes read at meetings, it says that of me that I'm an alcoholic and I can't manage my own life. I know that, so it says probably no human power is going to relieve my alcoholism. I know that to be true by experience. Every human power there was tried to get me to stop being. Every human power there was, she who must be obeyed begged me on behalf of herself and her many, many children to please stop. I could not stop drinking. It wasn't that I didn't want to or didn't intend to or didn't wish to be a husband and a father. I couldn't stop. I didn't have it in me to stop. And so I could not. It wasn't that I would not, I could not. My boss, the dean of the law school, I neglected to tell you, I had been let go, fired as a tenured professor of law. That was a big deal then, it's not a big deal now. He begged me to stop drinking. He said, I want you to stay here, you're a good teacher, but we can't have you here that way. And I was tenured, which means a lot in academia. Judges before I appeared said, you can't come in here like that. And I couldn't stop. I could not stop for love. I could not stop for money. I could not stop for career. I just couldn't stop. Well, I went to a meeting with the guy who delivered the mail, Al. And the meeting was an hour. I don't know what they did. But at the end of the meeting, Al came over and he said, I'll pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. And I said, that'll be fine, Al. And I haven't had a drink since. Maybe the post office has powers that you and I don't know about. Well, what is that? I'll tell you what that is. I'll tell you what it is, and it's nothing less than the grace of God. Nothing less than the grace of God. The whole thing is God inspired. And it's a power that sustains me, sustains this program, sustains each and one of us. It's a power that came into my life, is in your life. And it's not a difficult thing at all. Not at all difficult. This book says that God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And I found that to be true. And so have you. Is this a hard term this weekend? To be in this beautiful place? To be with each other, with people you know, people who know you, people who you love, people who love you. Is that a difficult term? God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And it says that he discloses himself to us as we draw near to him. And that isn't that the way we are one with each other? If you would like to know about me, join my group. Get in the car. Draw near to me. And little by little, you know how it works, I will reveal myself to you. We don't tell each other everything the first time. We learn of each other. We learn these things. And I've given the whole thing a lot of thought over the years, and it's simply God. And you don't have to, don't tell me you don't believe in God, because what you believe in has nothing to do with it. I have a fool now who, he doesn't want to say the first step prayer. He tells me he's an atheist. So I told him, I don't care what you believe in. You can be an atheist, you can think the world is flat. I'm telling you what to do. You will say the third step prayer. Or you will be one drunken atheist. And what you believe in has got a thing to do with it. But he's getting there. He thinks what he thinks is very important because he thinks it. Yeah? Interesting, and interesting stuff. And I'm not talking to you from any particular religious base, and I don't want to start giving you a sermon, but it's my opinion that the whole thing is God. And I was reminded of that not too long ago. The Grapevine reprinted that great correspondence between Carl Jung and Bill Wilson. And Bill Wilson wrote to Jung on the occasion of AA's 25th birthday in 1960. And told Jung we consider him a founder because of his advice to Roland Hazard, who gave it to Ebbie Thatcher, who gave it to Bill Wilson, who gave it to Bob Smith, and so on. And Jung wrote back a very interesting letter to great Jung. In January of 1961, the last year of his life, he wrote to Wilson, and he said, Roland Hazard's problem was that he had separated himself from the whole. W-H-O-L-E, in medieval terms, and I'm quoting, he had separated himself from God. And the great Jung, the great psychiatrist, gave an opinion that the disease of alcoholism results from a separation from God. And I don't know when I separated from God. I know I did. I don't know when that is true. I don't know when it happened. But I know this book says that there is one who has all power. That one is God. It says, may you find him now. And when I separated myself from all power, I became powerless. Yes? Yes. And so now it says that my task is to seek to improve a conscious contact with God. And I have found that power. As the book says, I would have found it. It says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the basic idea of God. Oh, it says, yeah, we cover it over with calamity and pomp and self-importance. But deep down in us is this fundamental idea of God. And it goes on to say, it was so with us. It was so with our founders. And they found that what I had to do in order to be usefully whole is to once again unite myself with God and with the power of God, which is no less than the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there came into this world in 1935 a power hitherto unknown, a great power. And it isn't necessary for me to further describe it, and I know I'm talking to the choir because it's in your life, or you wouldn't be here. I would be remiss if I didn't thank the committee, or Jim, Bob, or Mary, or Dick, or who the hell it was, had the good judgment to ask me to come by. Well, let me tell you something about that. You know, I don't know if you had this problem. I had it very rare. All my life I had a problem up to the time I came here. All my life I had a problem. Here was my problem. I never felt like I belonged anywhere. I wasn't connected. I knew without knowing, I knew I was in the wrong family. I didn't belong with that bunch. Believe me, they did the very best they could. And under the circumstance, and they were very good to me. But I never connected. I didn't, you know, they'd be having these things going on, I'd be hiding. I didn't belong there. And I felt that way all through school, and I was a hell of a student, and I never felt like I was good enough. You know, I didn't have a father, my clothes were dirty, I just felt out of it. I spent a lifetime on the outside looking in, and it made me angry. And at the end, I had this wonderful job as a law professor, and I'd find myself 4 o'clock in the morning in some dump, drinking, and the guy next to me would be spitting on my shoe or something, and I'd think to myself, Professor, I don't think you belong here. But I didn't want to go home either, and that was a very nice place with nice people, and I didn't feel well there. And of course, I couldn't talk to the other teachers at the school. What could I say? Did you get locked up last night? Did you ever set fire to yourself, Professor? So I spent the last years isolated by myself, and I didn't belong. And it annoyed me. It made me very unhappy, too. And then I came here to you, And I learned a different way. And it wasn't that big a deal, but it was a different way. And the 12 and 12 told me, and tells me that one of the great results of prayer and meditation is the sense of belonging that comes to us. It says, I am no longer lost or alone or frightened or purposeless, that I have had a glimpse of God's will, just a glimpse, enough to know that he lovingly watches out for me, enough to know that everything will be all right for me and for mine here and hereafter. And so it isn't so much that your committee is so kind to invite me here. The truth of the matter is this, I belong here. See? It's all right for me to be here. I'm a member. Isn't it? It's all right for me to be here. Sure. So that's why I thank you. I thank you for that. For giving me that sense of belonging. And allowing me to be part of this. I am supposed to tell you how things are. Oh, things are just great. Don't worry about the old piece. I'd tell you a few things, but, you know, if I'm hanging out with Mary and Dick, I'm very substantial. And I don't have to tell you what a great success I am, because I am one. Why bother? I've been a law professor now again for the last 25 years, and I'm a retired New York judge. But I'll tell you something really nice. I bring you the warm and the fraternal greetings of seven of my children who are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know if that's a record, but boy, it's a lot of distance. A lot of distance. I'm going to stop now, but first I want to read you something. I read this every morning because I think it helps me. Maybe you know what I'm going to read, and I suppose it will help you. I hope it does. Still you may say, but I will not have the benefit of you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that. So your real reliance must always be upon him. He will show you how to create the fellowship you crave. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. So you should ask him in your morning meditation what you can do for the man who suffers. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you do not have. See to it, your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and for countless others. And I will count this weekend as one of those great events that come to pass. I have a way of ending that I've been doing for many years. I refer you to a pamphlet in Alcoholics Anonymous, which has been very dear to me since it came out in the 70s, and is written by someone from around here. It's called The Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's our best pamphlet, and I recommend it to you if you haven't read it. But at the very last page of that, the author takes a biblical reference, and he recalls the time when John the Baptist was once again languishing in one of Herod's prisons. And John sent two of his friends to inquire of his cousin Jesus as to whether or not he was the Messiah, And so they found him, and they walked with him. And they stopped him one day, and they said, "Are you the Messiah? Are you the one that we've been waiting for all this time? Or should we wait for another?" And he really didn't answer that question, but he said to these two men, "Go back to John and tell John only what you have seen and only what you have heard. Tell John that the blind see and the lame walk. And tell John that the deaf can hear and that the sick are made well. And tell John that the poor have the gospel brought to them." In my early training, I was told that the word poor in that context could mean poor in spirit. And everybody knows that the word gospel simply means good news. And so, my dear, dear sisters and brothers, in happy convention assembled, if you will accept a report from me based on my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will tell you only what I've seen and only what I've heard. And based on that personal observation, it seems to me that the blind do see and the lame do walk. And I know that the deaf can hear. I know that. And most certainly, almost certainly, the sick are made well. And I have seen over and over and over again through the longest day and into the darkest night the good news of this program brought to the alcoholic who suffers, the poor in spirit. God bless you.